Have you seen that vigilante man? Have you seen that vigilante man? Have you seen that vigilante man? I've been hearing his name all over the land. Well, what is a vigilante man? Tell me, what is a vigilante man? Has he got a club in his hand? Is that a vigilante man? Rainy night down in the engine house, sleeping just as still as a mouse. Man come along and chased us in the rain. Vigilante man. Stormy days we'd pass the time away, sleeping in some good warm place. A cop come along and we give him a little raise. Say, was that your vigilante man? Preacher Casey was just a working man, and he said, unite all us working men. They killed him in the river, some strange man. Was that your vigilante man? Why does a vigilante man? Oh, why does a vigilante man carry that sawed-off shotgun in his hand? Would he shoot his brother and sister down? I rambled around from town to town. I rambled around from town to town. And they herded us around like a wild herd of cattle. Is that your vigilante man? Have you seen that vigilante man? Have you seen that vigilante man? I've heard his name all over this land.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining up with us, we're listening to journalist Matt Taibbi tell Tom Ashbrook and us about a huge and growing divide in the U.S. justice system. Matt visits the issues of big money buying innocence and poverty often resulting in guilt.
Collateral consequences still on the mind of the prosecutor right there. What about at the other end? I mean, you make a pretty strong claim that we have, by inattention or by design, you tell me, criminalized the poor. What do you really mean by that?
Well, we've instituted all across the country, we have these new statistics-based policing strategies where most people have heard of the broken windows theory of policing, and the idea there is that if you arrest people for very small things, then they will be less likely to commit serious crimes. The example they usually give is, if you know that you're going to be arrested for jumping a turnstile in a subway, you're less likely to bring an illegal gun out into the street because you don't want to be caught for that when you're caught for doing something really small and stupid at the same time. And so this began in the early 90s, it created this new system of policing in the inner cities. And people here in New York City, and in cities all across America, especially in minority communities, they know all about what this is. A couple of years ago, just to give you an example, in New York, they stopped and frisked 680 1,000 people, 88% of which were black or Hispanic. They handed out 600,000 summonses for things like carrying an open container. That were 80,000 summonses for that. 20,000 for riding the wrong way down a sidewalk on a bicycle. 50,000 for marijuana, even though that's decriminalized in New York City. You can actually carry a joint legally. But if they ask you to empty your pockets and suddenly it's in plain view, then it's illegal all of a sudden. So what they're basically doing is throwing a net over whole communities, dragging everybody in. They're looking for guns and for warrants for people who are fugitives. And the idea is to throw the innocent ones back, but in practice, they don't always do that. What they end up doing instead is proceeding with these really stupid cases involving minor infractions like carrying an open container or, in the case of one person that I interviewed for my book, obstructing pedestrian traffic, which it turns out is a very common offense that you can be stopped for in New York, which basically means being black on a Tuesday night. You have a guy who's standing in front of his own house
at 1 a.m. in your story, not much pedestrian traffic then.
Yeah, he was literally standing in front of his own house with a friend, listening to music. They were sharing a set of headphones, and this guy's a bus driver. He's wearing a tie. He's got his ID around his neck. He's a working man who just came home, and the police just didn't like the looks of him, and they arrested him and wrote him up for obstructing pedestrian traffic. And I met this man in a law office, and like most white people in New York, I had no idea that you could be arrested for obstructing pedestrian traffic or that such a law even existed. But it turns out that's a very common offense in this city, and it's just part of what the city councilman in Baltimore described as an epidemic of false arrest in the inner cities, where policemen cook up all kinds of spurious probable cause reasons to stop and arrest people, and this is the norm in the inner cities. And I tell these stories to contrast it with the lack of attention that people get when they work in the financial services industry, in the pharmaceutical industry, where it's very, very difficult to get law enforcement interested in a case, even if they're very, very serious.
And with that, you may have, Matt Taibbi says, the criminalization of the poor and a kind of free pass society emerged here for the wealthy when they press the edges of the law. Matt Taibbi, stand by in New York. I want to get to some perspective on this. Arthur Labey joins us right now from Camden, New Jersey. He's professor of law at Rutgers, specializes in securities law and regulation. Professor Labey, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom.
What do you make of Matt Taibbi's depiction of sort of economic halls of power being almost exempt from a legal prosecution and imprisonment, even when wrong is done while we criminalize the poor? How's that hit your ear, Professor Labey?
Yeah, it's very interesting. Fundamentally, I don't necessarily disagree with much of what Matt Taibbi says, and I always look forward to his writings. But I do think that the situation is a bit more complex and more subtle than it might appear at first blush. So, for example, there have been significant high-level prosecutions of white-collar crime that many of us have seen over the past few years. The government prosecuted Raj Rajaratnam for insider trading. He was convicted in 2011. He was sentenced to 11 years in prison. McKinsey director Rajat Gupta was sentenced to 2 years in jail. The prosecutors recently charged SAC Capital Advisors with insider trading. The firm settled for $1.8 billion in penalties, but more importantly, eight current or former employees of the firm were charged and were convicted or pleaded guilty, some of whom will most certainly go to jail. Also, I think just as importantly, there's been, I think, a sea change in the way many of these investigations are carried out, which I think is not clear if you look at Mr. Taibbi's writing. So in white-collar cases, I think there's been a change, perhaps a change for the better, where the government is really using tactics that were traditionally reserved for organized crime and gang prosecutions, and really getting very, very tough on white-collar crime through using wiretaps, which they did in the case of Mr. Rajaratnam, use of informers, use of undercover and sting operations. That's really a significant change in the way investigations are carried out. The investigations are being done not necessarily after the fact, but really simultaneously with the carrying out of the crime. And these are all, I think, significant changes which reflect that we do take white-collar crime seriously, and the government pursues it fairly aggressively.
Matt, what do you make of that? Raj Rajaratnam, Mr. Gupta, the SAC fine, and eight employees, former employees, some may go to jail, so there's the bite of justice.
Not one of those instances had anything to do with the financial crisis of 2008. Those were insider trading cases. They could have happened at any era, in any period. And many of the principals, especially Stevie Cohen, involving SAC, he's going to walk away with an enormous fortune, almost no matter what happens in that case. And when you're talking about using tactics against they use against organized crime and against gangs, how come there haven't been any RICO prosecutions against any of these companies? The only RICO case that I could find that involved mortgages in the last 5 or 6 years involved a Lincoln Park gangster in Los Angeles, who had a RICO case pushed against him for trafficking in some kind of mortgage scam at a very, very low level. But none of these banks that were involved in wide-ranging subprime mortgage fraud have been prosecuted at all. And again, nobody who was connected to the systemic frauds that led to the crisis has faced any kind of prosecution. There was only one prosecution that one could even call related to the financial crisis, and that was a pair of Bear Stearns employees. They worked for a Bear Stearns-related hedge fund. They were acquitted in a Los Angeles court. And after that case, there really hasn't been anything criminal.
Hear great speeches and interviews at Access Sacramento every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Fool me once, shame on you. Just fool me, we can't get fooled again.
People think I'm a moron. What if they only knew the depth of my evil genius? And I can be stupid whenever I need to, yeah. In my midnight confessions, I reveal my imperial secrets. I'm the master of misdirection, with a few intellectual defects. There's a little rubber moon I keep in my hand, you better understand. If and when I should push it, the raw heads will fly, kiss the planet goodbye.
I'm a threat to the American people.
Busy day at the White House. We're planning World War III. I'm looking out for my corporate sponsors. Say I'll cut down, but I'm letting them run scot-free. In my midnight confessions, I reveal my imperial secrets. I'm the master of misdirection, with a few intellectual defects.
Volunteer for overseas, like he's indicated to the media, then one of the overseas areas would have been also blacked out. So since they weren't, I think it's pretty safe to assume that he checked, do not volunteer for overseas. So all his rhetoric is just more hypocrisy and lies. He was definitely draft dodging.
I don't think we need to be subliminal. Hold this nation hostile. Yeah.
Mr. Nurse.
In 1994, there were 67 schools in Texas that were rated exemplary.
Well, sir, I ain't a for real cowboy, but I am one hell of a stud.
There is no malfeasance involved to account for a complicated transaction.
I know nothing, nothing.
Prescription drugs will be an integral part of the Medicare plan. Always chew your pretzels before you swallow.
I'm a threat to the American people.
And to the C students, you too can be president of the United States.
And now, back to Matt Taibbi, Tom Ashbrook, and Unfair Justice.
Arthur Leiby, are you cherry-picking these high-profile prosecutions? Do you have a concern that there's a wider laxity about justice at this level of our society?
No, if we're talking about criminal cases as a result of the financial crisis, then fundamentally I don't disagree with what Matt Taibbi says. There have been some SEC cases. Those have generally been against institutions. Those cases are typically settled. But I think the more important point is that there are really very significant challenges in bringing criminal cases and, for that matter, SEC cases that try to allege fraud. And if you compare it with the SNL crisis, there's really quite a big difference. I mean, much of what was done during the financial crisis was unfortunately legal. And so to bring a criminal case, this is quite complicated. One needs to have the right evidence. One needs to be able to show intent. Intent means proving that the defendants had a particular state of mind. And just because in our legal system, just because bad things happen, that doesn't necessarily mean that there's enough evidence to bring a criminal case.
Let me ask you this. I take your point. Matt quotes in the front piece of his book, Justice Potter Stewart, saying, fairness is what justice really is. It may be difficult, and I don't doubt that, but given the way our law is arranged today, are we achieving fairness in the terms that Matt's describing here between classes?
Well, fairness is, as you can imagine, a very sort of open-ended term, and what is fairness to one person is not fairness to another person. So certainly if we look at certain aspects of society, and I won't get into the details that Mr. Taibbi has, then sure, we could make arguments that there is certainly in some areas a lack of general overarching fairness. And indeed, I think it's great that Matt Taibbi makes this part of the conversation. But I think to the extent that he suggested earlier that, well, you have, you know, government officials who just aren't acting aggressively enough because they come from the private sector, I just speaking personally, I don't necessarily buy that thesis. Sure, the government should enforce its conflict of interest rules better. I don't disagree with that, but I don't agree that government officials are necessarily soft on white-collar crime due to this so-called revolving door. And there's evidence to the contrary. You know, there's a 2012 study from some accountants that demonstrated that, in fact, this so-called revolving door, people moving from government to the private sector, that it's actually helpful because government officials want to show that they're quite aggressive, and taking a hard line and being tough is actually more likely to influence a future employer. Who would you want to hire? Would you want to hire the person who kind of doesn't take direction and is soft on everybody? Or would you want to hire the official who, when they are in office, they're quite aggressive and they really go after the wrongdoers? That's who one might want to say, gee, we want to bring those folks on board in the long run.
Arthur Leiby, professor of law at Rutgers. We're going to put those points to Matt Taibbi. I appreciate your raising them with us here today. Thank you very much for joining us from Camden.
My pleasure. Thanks, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about American justice in the great age of inequality. My guest, Matt Taibbi, says the rich get off and the poor get criminalized as a class, and many, many locked up, more than in any culture, any society in history, he points out, in the United States today. His new book is The Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. Matt, there are issues from Professor Leiby I want to raise, but we've got a lot of callers waiting as well. Dave in Madison, Wisconsin. Dave, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. So I'm a criminal defense attorney, and I wanted to cite an example from experience that seems to reveal a double standard.
Okay.
Mr. Taibbi had mentioned the HSBC money laundering case and the $1.9 billion settlement, I believe, which as a fraction of the profit, you know, is only a fraction of profits they made off of that.
And these were accusations that they transferred billions for countries like Iran. They enabled Mexican drug cartels to move money illegally through American subsidiaries. Yeah.
Yeah, they're not accusations. They admitted it.
Admitted, yes.
Right. And senior level executives basically willfully ignored or knowing did this. And I would contrast that with a street level drug dealer in federal court. And what you have is if the feds suspect that a defense attorney is being paid out of proceeds from drug sales, the feds can and do seek to confiscate the attorney's fee under those circumstances.
Okay.
And we can I think, well know how that might affect the quality of representation that a street-level drug dealer might receive.
That's going to scare off a lot of attorneys right there, Dave.
Certainly. And you know, when you see the contrast there, that's striking. And the other thing I'd just say is that, you know, if you're a street-level drug dealer, deterrence isn't as effective in my experience. But when you have senior executives in these major companies, the threat of going to jail, if real and perceived to be real, really does have a deterrent effect. And so you have a sort of upside-down incentive system, which I think cannot be effective in conduct at the highest level. So that's all I'd have to say about that, but it seems like a striking example.
Yeah, I appreciate your call, Dave. Different qualities of representation with radically different outcomes suggested there, Matt.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've heard actually that same argument made to me before. And I've also heard an argument made from the other side of the table. I spoke with a former federal prosecutor who did a lot of high-level drug cases. He used to work in Florida back in the sort of the 80s and the cocaine days. And he told me that as a matter of course, when they wanted to add a whole bunch of years to a suspect in a drug case, they just charged him with money laundering, and they would get 10, 15 extra years in those cases. So it's not unusual. If you can just look online and Google money laundering and conviction and look at people who've gotten lots and lots of years for this offense. And again, in this case, you have one of the worst money laundering cases, drug money laundering cases in the history of narcotics investigations, and nobody got even one day. So it's just harder to have a more stark contrast than that.
I mean, it's not just Matt Taibbi saying this. I'm reading here from William C. Dudley, president and chief executive officer. This is from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. These are remarks last fall in New York. He's talking about, he says, an important problem evident within some large financial institutions, the apparent lack of respect for law, regulation, and the public trust. There's evidence of deep-seated cultural and ethical failures at many large financial institutions. And he goes on in that vein. And this is, I mean, you have a reputation as a pretty hot riding pistol. This is, you know, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York saying it.
Oh yeah, no, and presidents of Fed branches all over the country have been saying the same thing. Look, the reason that this is important is that when there was no response, no criminal response to 2008, what could you have predicted? You could have predicted that even worse criminal behavior would have happened next, because people would have been emboldened to do even worse things, and that's exactly what has happened. We've seen far worse scandals since 2008. The LIBOR scandal, which involves worldwide manipulation of interest rates, involving some of the biggest financial companies in the world, it couldn't possibly be more serious than that. There's a similar scandal going on in the Forex markets. We've seen manipulation of metals prices. We're seeing all kinds of things that we never would have seen 10 years ago. And I think it has to be laid at the feet of the fact that we didn't prosecute people when we had the chance.
Outside the window, there's a woman being grabbed. They've dragged her to the bushes, and now she's being stabbed. Maybe we should call the cops and try to stop the pain. But Monopoly is so much fun, I'd hate to blow the game. And I'm sure it wouldn't interest anybody outside of a small circle of friends. Riding down the highway, yes, my back is getting stiff. 13 cars have piled up, they're hanging on a cliff. Now maybe we should pull them back with our towing chain. But we gotta move and we might get sued, and it looks like it's gonna rain. And I'm sure it wouldn't interest anybody outside of a small circle of friends. Sweating in the ghetto with the colored and the poor. The rats have joined the babies who are sleeping on the floor. Now wouldn't it be a riot if they really blew their tops? But they got too much already, and besides we've got the cops. And I'm sure it wouldn't interest anybody outside of a small circle of friends. Oh, there's a dirty paper using sex to make her sad. The Supreme Court was so upset they sent him off to jail. Maybe we should help the fiend and take away his spine. But we're busy reading Playboy and the Sunday New York Times, and I'm sure it wouldn't interest anybody outside of a small circle of friends. Smoking marijuana is more fun than drinking beer, but a friend of ours was captured and they gave him 30 years. Maybe we should raise our voices, ask somebody why. But demonstrations are a drag, besides we're much too high, and I'm sure it wouldn't interest anybody outside of a small circle of friends. Dragged her to the bushes and now she's being stabbed. Maybe we should call the cops and try to stop the pain. But Monopoly is so much fun, I'd hate to blow the game. And I'm sure it wouldn't interest anybody outside of a small circle of friends.
And now, messages from Access Sacramento.